Hello, you are listening to Physics Frontiers number 34, CPT Symmetry and Gravitation. Show notes can be found at frontiers.physicsfm.com/34.
So, hey Randy, what's going on?
Good evening, Jim.
What do you think we should talk about today, Randy?
Tonight, we're going to talk about probably the leading taboo in physics.
The taboo? What is this taboo that we're going to talk about?
You know, I've always felt like there shouldn't be any taboos in science. But if there has ever been a taboo in science, it's the taboo against all talk of anti-gravity.
Oh, we're not allowed to talk about anti-gravity. And what kind of anti-gravity are we talking about today?
Well, you found these wonderful papers by M. Vallotta that discusses the possibility that gravitational charge is sort of akin to electrical charge, and that in antimatter, it may be reversed, so that the gravitational interaction between matter and antimatter could be repulsive, theoretically.
Massimo Vallotta?
Nobody ever seems to use his first name, so he just seems to prefer M. So I'm just going to go with it, if that's the way he wants it.
When he writes science fiction, that might not be science fiction, that might be fiction about science. So it's Massimo Vallotta. So we had this really interesting idea about how gravity works and how to make some sense of some of the things that we see in astronomy. So how did you want to work here? Did you want to work with the local void stuff, or did you want to get into the CPT symmetry first?
Well, as a rule, I like to do things chronologically, because I feel like the authors often build on their own ideas and bring them into the observational areas later that kind of makes them a more rounded theory. But it's nice to study the theoretical motivations first and really see where they're coming from.
How do you understand this? What Vallotta is saying is that he thinks that it's possible, so he hasn't really done the derivations, but he's got some suggestive work, that if you try to apply CPT symmetry, charge parity time symmetry, on a curved space-time, you get a situation where you have a sort of negative gravitational charge in general relativity. So I guess the first question is, how much do you understand about CPT symmetry?
Well, I don't understand it in probably as much depth as it actually represents in physics, because it seems to have an incredibly broad and powerful symmetry. I understand that CPT invariance is sacrosanct, if not more sacrosanct, than like conservation of energy. Like, it's a law of just how nature works.
That is what we think, right? But for a long time, people thought just CP symmetry was inviolate. That whenever you changed all of the directions of space, if you took a wave function and inverted it, basically, and changed its parity, you would have to change its charge so that the particle would go from being negatively charged to positively charged. And this is basically the sort of idea that you get with the theory of the positron, right? Or originally the theory of the electron from Dirac. At some point in the 1950s, I believe, do you remember who got the CP violation?
I'm not sure who found this first CP violation, no.
Oh, okay, it was in the 1960s with the decay of neutral kaons, and that was by James Cronin and Val Fitch. They were able to find, in a really classic case, a CP violation, and that CP violation meant that something that people thought was a law of nature was not a law of nature. Now, it turned out that you could fix that by putting one more symmetry in that group. So as long as you reversed the time evolution of the wave function, or the evolution of the wave function, you'd get the same thing. So now you're dealing with a four-space symmetry rather than a three-space symmetry. And this goes along with one of your favorite things, which is this idea about the electron going forward and backward in time.
I'm not sure if that's ringing a bell. That's one of my favorite things. What kind of scenario are we talking about there? It's not ringing.
Richard Feynman had this idea that he got from Wheeler. So he published a paper on it in like 1948 or something, but he says that he got it from a conversation with John Wheeler in 1941. So that paper was called A Relativistic Cutoff for Classical Electrodynamics. And in that, he was talking a little bit about what happens at a potential barrier with an electron. And normally, what will happen is an electron, when it passes through that potential barrier, take the path of least time. You know, that changes its direction while it's in the potential barrier. And then when it comes out, it's got a different, it changes its speed when it goes through the potential barrier and probably its direction as well. And when it comes out of the potential barrier, it has the original speed again. But it's possible that if you have the right potential barrier, that the electron can do something like go forward in time, reach the potential barrier, sneak backwards in time a little bit, and then come out the other end. And that's actually more energetically favorable. And while it's going backwards in that potential barrier, it's actually a positron. That was Feynman's idea. And I thought this was one of the things that you kept wanting to talk about at some point.
Oh, yeah, the whole idea about antimatter being like time-reversed matter.
This is something that not only shows up here, it shows up later on, because if you look at all of the diagrams for Compton scattering, which is not one of the more complicated, exotic things that happens in quantum mechanics, if you look at it relativistically in quantum field theory, some of those diagrams that you have to add up to get your amplitudes for the Compton scattering include either electron-positron creation and annihilation, or one electron going forward in time, backwards in time, and then forwards in time again. There isn't any real way to tell that there's a difference between these two things. And so this is sort of the time-reversed antimatter idea. And this is more or less what Velotta is going for, only on a curved space-time and stuff like that. So he's trying to show if you're on a curved space-time and you have this idea about how antimatter works, you also end up with a negative gravitational charge.
That makes sense, because if matter is going to fall into a gravity well, then the time-reversed matter would want to fall out of it, right? What we were looking at in one of our previous shows very recently, retrocausality, could be that at the quantum scale that there really isn't a preferred direction of time. That could be a purely statistical artifact. So if that's true, then maybe matter at this quantum scale could have a time-reversed symmetry, you know?
That's exactly what Velotta is saying. But, I mean, after you get to that point, you have to ask yourself, why is it, if there's all this antimatter going backwards in time, don't I see it?
Where he, later on, he talks about how he thinks it could be in the cosmic voids, but it's not illuminating.
I mean, that's a good place to talk about it. Why don't you see the antimatter coming from the cosmic void? I mean, what's the issue?
I wish I'd had more time to dig into this, but I started to read that Isaac Barr's paper. What is it, a physical interpretation of anti-gravity, I think the paper was called, where he talks about that maybe that there's regions that are gravity-dominated, and there's a problem observing the antimatter-dominated regions. But I didn't get far enough into the paper to understand the mechanism for it. But that's how he seemed to resolve some of the fundamental physics issues with the idea of anti-gravity, is that maybe there's an observational barrier.
I would like to talk about those at some point in the future. Now, what Velotta says is that you end up with two kinds of photons.
Ah, and so the antimatter photons would be repelled by the gravitational field of galaxy clusters, and therefore we wouldn't see that many of them, if any.
So just like there's gravitational lensing, if you've got this photon traveling forward in time, bends one way in the gravity well. If it's going in the opposite direction in time, it would bend basically the other way.
Yeah, I think they're looking for an effect like that as they're studying dark energy. I think it's called the late integrated Wolf-Sachs effect. The idea is that they think that in the large regions between galaxy clusters, that since dark energy is dominant there, that they'll be able to detect this opposite gravitational lensing, like gravitational delensing effect. And so that's one of the things they're looking for right now, I think, with the dark energy survey. But, I think, and I guess those would be cosmic voids, is these, underpopulated areas. But they're assuming that those areas are, largely devoid of matter, and they seem to be. And so it's a very diffuse effect. It's not like the really sweet, sharp lensing effects that we see around galaxy clusters and that kind of thing, It's just a lot harder to detect. I'm not sure that they've really verified that effect yet, but they do expect to see it. So maybe we'll be able to see some evidence for Velotta's ideas in that research.
Hopefully, yeah. So when you were reading this, was there anything in here that you really had and that you really saw as interesting about the CPT symmetry?
Well, as far as the CPT symmetry aspect of it goes, yeah, I liked the way that he approached GR and took a look at and very specifically applied the CPT inversions to the metric tensor equation to show you how general relativity predicts that matter attracts matter, antimatter attracts antimatter, but matter and antimatter repel. I thought that was a really fascinating look at the math, the mechanics of it,
Yeah, and a lot of people thought one reason why there wouldn't be a negative gravitational charge is because general relativity has a second rank potential. The metric tensor is basically a second rank potential, that G. So it's kind of like a matrix. Anything with an even rank will have attractive charges, but it should be like charges attract, whereas anything with an odd potential will have like charges repelling, which is an interesting result in and of itself, although apparently very complicated. So the book that I found for these references for Velotta in, which was Alberto Vecchiato's Variational Approach to Gravity Field Theories, when it talked about that particular effect, it said, don't bother going to the original reference. Find this other book that has an explanation, because that is an extremely technical paper, even for somebody who's writing a book on variational approaches to gravitational theories. So I guess the idea here is that you'd have this situation where like charges attract, positive attracts positive, negative attracts negative. That means you're going to get this clustering, especially if they repel, right? They repel one another. And it seems from what Velotta has shown that you end up getting something where if you go deep down into it, basically what you get for a force equation will be something like what we see normally.
With electrodynamics, you mean?
Not so much with the electrodynamics. I mean, he talks a little bit about the electrodynamics one, but that's just more or less to show that if you do the CPT symmetry on electrodynamics in this curved space-time, or on electrodynamics, not in the curved space-time, everything comes out normal. But that's completely expected, because if it didn't come out normal, somebody would have noticed a long time ago. Electrodynamics, you can do a lot of lab experiments. You'd be able to create the right conditions to find a violation. But he goes through that just to show you what he's going to do with gravitation. And he brings about a force equation, which is an approximation to general relativity, and kind of shows that assuming one thing about the Christoffel symbols, one thing about these things that are the relativistic analog to the force, then you end up with a negative gravitational charge.
What did he have to assume about these, about the Christoffel symbol?
He basically had to assume that it doesn't switch its sign. So everything else in that equation, or things with indices, the vectors, the speeds, basically, those change their signs. The differentials change their signs in that. But the Christoffel symbol should not change its sign. I think he's a little more explicit about it in the dark energy in the local void paper. If we transform only one of the two components, either the field or the particle, we get a change in sign that converts the original gravitational attraction into a repulsion so that matter and antimatter repel each other. So I guess that makes sense. If you're looking at this not as looking at the curvature of space-time, but looking at it in terms of a force, and you look at the force on one particle from another particle, then if you sort of reverse the charge on the particle, that doesn't do anything to the field, and vice versa. But he's pretty explicit in that particular paper that he hasn't really shown that to be the case. So basically there's a line somewhere about halfway through the paper that more or less would say something like, if you can show that both of these things change sign under a CPT transformation, where you change all three of those quantities, charge, parity, and time, then none of this is any good, so you can stop reading the paper now. But then he goes on to talk about what will happen if you only change one, which is much more interesting. So why don't we talk about that one instead?
Yeah, that's how he arrived at his determination that with the time reversal of antimatter, you'd get a gamma in the rest frame of minus one instead of one. I thought that was fascinating.
Yeah, he's got a factor in there, which is the derivative of the coordinate time with respect to the proper time. And in the rest frame of matter, that's one. In the rest frame of antimatter, that's minus one. Basically saying that the antimatter is going backwards in time. So that whole Wheeler-Feynman or Wheeler-Stuckberg or whatever they call it.
Yeah, it's Wheeler-Stuckelberg.
Wheeler-Stuckelberg theory.
Feynman-Stuckelberg, I think it was.
Feynman-Stuckelberg theory. That Feynman-Stuckelberg theory would be okay, which would be great because, you know, it's always fun to hear about that one for the first time because it just makes so much sense. It's just something bouncing around in time rather than, you know, something being created out of thin air.
Yeah, it's an intriguing idea that you really can seem to describe all of the physics of antimatter by describing it as time and parity and charge reversed matter. It's an elegant idea.
Exactly. It's just amazing. It really is amazing. Okay, so that's what I've got for that. Do you have anything more?
Well, I think it would be good to mention that physicists have been trying to measure the gravitational interaction of antimatter for decades now. And they always seem to think they're close to it, right?
That's what I've heard. I had a professor who was creating superconductors so that they could drop antimatter through a superconductor cylinder. It turned out that they weren't able to make the superconductor symmetrical enough, so the antimatter at some point ended up hitting the walls of the cylinder and, you know, exploding. So that was what they were trying a long, long time ago. Do you know anything about this AEGIS experiment that's going on at CERN?
Yes, I think there's three different collaborations actually going on at CERN right now at the Large Hadron Collider, where they're trying to measure the gravitational interaction of antimatter. And at least one of them, but it might be all three of them, are trying to make anti-hydrogen and then cooling it way down so that it's moving at like ordinary terrestrial kind of velocities. So they can then shoot it through an uncharged cylinder, I guess, and then try to measure the deflection from gravity. But it's proving to be an incredibly arduous task. That's probably the hardest thing that physics has probably ever tried to do. Because trying to measure antimatter falling in a gravitational field, if you think about how difficult it is to get a really high vacuum so you don't have any collisions, because as soon as you have any kind of collisions with antimatter, you generate all this energy and that heats it up. And, you know, it's a mess trying to make this measurement. So we don't know yet. We haven't measured yet. There's strong theoretical arguments, I think, that antimatter should fall down. But on the other hand, when you look at them really closely, there's also really strong arguments on the other side. So we really need this measurement. And it's incredible that it's taking so long. I mean, I know they've been talking about doing it, like trying to get this measurement for 20 years, I think.
I mean, it's just hard to do. I mean, gravity experiments already are hard to do.
Yeah, because it's a weak force to start with, right?
And then you're trying to do it with something that's very, very hard to store. And the whole problem is, the reason why you need the anti-hydrogen is you can't do it with any charged particle, because that electromagnetic force is going to be so much greater that it's going to swamp everything out. So very, very difficult. And I guess they probably have some sort of funding issues. And I'm only saying that because I looked at the AEGIS website and there was something about crowdfunding.
Oh, dear.
Hopefully whatever issue they have right now is fixed by the time I get this edited in 3 to 7 months. But it looks like they're having some sort of funding issues if they need to do crowdfunding.
Right. Next, we're going to be driving by physicists on the street corner holding signs out. You know, like, we'll work on particle physics for food.
They'd probably do it for a new magnet. Maybe not for food, though. Particle physicists don't need food. Somebody's going to be really angry at me now.
Don't feed the particle physicists.
It will be interesting if the AEGIS experiment actually gets something done, or either of the other two experiments you were talking about. Just that, you know, looking there, they don't seem to be publishing a lot of papers. Probably because they don't have any results right now. But still, I mean, if you'd like to see more.
Well, there was a paper a few years ago, and they were like, well, we got our first results out of this experiment, and we found out that to within, I don't know, 30,000 parts or something, that matter seems to fall down, and antimatter, you know, we really don't know. It was like, they got results, but the results were just so incredibly noisy that they couldn't tell anything.
So you're saying they were almost able to show that the Earth attracts matter?
Yeah. there was a little statistical significance in there where you'd think that there might be something called a gravitational field or something like that, you know.
Okay, so I guess then you might want to know some reason why you would actually believe that something like this is going on. So do you think you can explain why you might want to have something like negative gravitation?
Well, I think that one of the things that comes up with this debate is the baryogenesis problem. If we seem to be missing an awful lot of antimatter, like why are there more baryons in the universe than anti-baryons? And this idea says, well, there is. There's an equal amount of antimatter in the universe, and it's anti-gravitating. So their conservation of all of the different physical laws that we hold, baryon number, lepton number, charge, all of that stuff would be conserved, which is what we'd like to see with the Big Bang.
Yeah, so it would be nice to see that. I guess there are some other things here that he talked about. He said basically that if this happens, if you have this anti-gravity, you don't have any need of an inflaton or any strange exotic particle in the Big Bang.
And any way that you look at it, right, there has to be basically some kind of anti-gravitational effect in the early universe. because even by the conventional descriptions, we say that space-time expanded at this incredible rate. Well, that is an anti-gravitational effect. Whether you attribute to the inflaton or anything else, it's just like with dark energy. There's an anti-gravitational effect. Is it the result of a scalar field of dark energy that we can't observe for some reason? Or is it a curvature intrinsic to the universe? We don't know, but the effect definitely seems to be a repulsive gravitation. But on top of that, he also talked about how, and this is a wonderful idea, I remember talking to a friend about this at least a decade ago, if there is an anti-gravitating field, or whether it's coming from antimatter galaxies we don't see or whatever, but if it's pushing on the galaxy apart and accelerating it, that could also be pushing on the matter at the outer boundaries of galaxies and galaxy clusters to create the illusion of dark matter. Because the gravitational repulsion that's forcing in towards the center is just going to look exactly the same as having more mass in the center, pulling it in.
Yeah, so this is actually one of the things he mentioned, is that not only could you get a dark energy-like thing out of this, you could also explain some of the dark matter, especially if you end up not having dark energy just be a cosmological constant, the same number everywhere in the universe, right? If that negative energy density fluctuates, then you probably have something a lot more like repulsive gravity. Or at least that's the statement here. You know, this ends up being an explanation, again, for dark energy. And we like things like that.
Yeah. Some kind of phenomenology that you can mechanistically understand.
Yeah, I think somewhere in here, Velada calls dark energy embarrassing.
Yeah, twice.
Because, you know, what is it? Well, it's unexpected. It just kind of showed up. We don't really know what it is.
And it's doing something we said would be impossible for decades. And then here we are in the modern era where it seems like we can't explain any of the huge mysteries in our cosmological model without it.
But you have no idea what it is. That's really the worst thing, is that we don't know what this is. And the same thing with dark matter. Now we're down to these wimps, but how many other dark matter candidates were there before? But they've just been shedding the candidates, because the more and more realistic the dark matter looks, the harder and harder it is for it to do what it needs to do, to not interact enough that we can't see it, but still interact enough to attract other objects at certain spots. Obviously, if we can find one reason to get rid of both of those things, that's great, but either one of them, just having a reason for those things to be there would be wonderful. But I think the most interesting reason he was talking about was sort of the distribution of velocity.
The distribution of velocity where?
The velocity anomaly, I think it was.
Oh, yeah, where he was talking about the movement of all the galaxies in our neighborhood of the universe.
So there seems to be, what, a 631 kilometer per second anomaly after you've taken into account lots of different things like the Earth's motion around the sun's motion in the galaxy around M31. So you still have 631 kilometers per second. That doesn't make any sense. And that can be decomposed into three parts.
This was fascinating, yeah.
And two of those make some sense, right? One was an attraction to the Virgo cluster. One was the great attractor that was generally towards the Centaurus cluster. And then there was the local velocity anomaly, which is about 259 kilometers per second. And it's not directed towards anything in particular.
Apparently, all three of these components are like orthogonal to each other. And this last one seems to be pointed directly away from the local void.
Yes. So it's pointing in the opposite direction of the local void, but not towards anything in particular. So that's a really good indication that there's something going on in that void. And that's perpendicular to the local sheet. And this repulsive gravity would actually give you a reason why the sheet is so flat.
Oh, right. Because it's sort of getting pressed from the outside voids.
Yeah. I mean, it doesn't really make any sense. Why would this thing be flat? Well, if there's stuff on the outside pushing it in, then that makes a little bit of sense.
Otherwise, it should collapse into like a circular rope and then collapse further into a sphere. It's really fascinating. You know, you get the idea that he did any kind of calculation to try to figure out that if there were, for example, a big galaxy cluster in the middle of the local void, if the photons, the, I guess would be time-inverted photons or something, from those galaxies, would the gravity of our local galaxy cluster really be strong enough to make it lens around us so that we wouldn't see it, so that it would be dark to us? It seems like asking an awful lot of gravity to bend the light that much that we wouldn't see antimatter galaxies in there.
I did not see anything in here that said he did that calculation.
They've done experiments with anti-hydrogen, and they see that the photons released are the same frequency. It has like the same excitation level. So we know that we can detect the light from antimatter. So the only way that we wouldn't be seeing it is if the gravity of a local galaxy cluster is strong enough to make it sort of bend away from us.
Well, I mean, he talking a little bit about this. The photon is going along one of these null geodesics. I don't see how you'd end up with a state where you couldn't detect it along that. The time doesn't make any sense anymore along that line, right? Or at least the space-time interval is zero. It's a little hard to figure out exactly what would happen. I did get a little bit of an impression that he thought that might be difficult, but now that I'm looking at my notes on the subject, he didn't actually say that. He had a couple of things about the photons, but he didn't actually seem to say, well, you're not going to detect one of these advanced photons.
Right, yeah. I don't think he said anything definitive about it. I'd love to see a calculation of that and see if we could figure it out. Like, because it's very baffling. I mean, I've always assumed that photons are photons, that whether they are emitted by matter or antimatter, they'd be the same thing. So wouldn't you need a different theory of the photon for it to behave differently in a gravitational field like that?
I'm not sure. I don't know if it would be like it is. I'd assume it would be like it is in electrodynamics. And so in electrodynamics, I mean, you just keep the retarded photon and you get rid of the advanced one. You keep the retarded radiation and you get rid of the advanced radiation.
Right, because the advanced one is the one that goes back in time.
I'm not sure what that would mean for photons and stuff like that in the long run. After you do this CPT symmetry in a curved spacetime. I don't know. Do we have any other things? I have one other thing. What else do you have?
Well, let's see here. I don't have anything off the top of my head. Why don't you just jump ahead with whatever you got?
Okay, so one of these interesting things that he was talking about was if you have this antimatter going backwards in time.
Oh, that it might evolve in a different way.
I don't think that he said in a different way. It should probably evolve in exactly the same way, only...
But backwards in time, right.
But it's going backwards in time, and since we're actually in a fairly early part of the universe, it would be in a fairly late stage.
That's so weird. It's like a universe within a universe. So it would be at a different age, moving in a different direction, so it might be in a different state of cosmic evolution than the matter around it.
So if the antimatter is going backwards in time, that means that its Big Bang would be like the Big Crunch, if there is a Big Crunch, right? Because right now people don't think there would be. But, you know, you'd assume that if it's completely symmetric because of all this stuff, then what's going to happen is, you know, you have the Big Crunch acting as the antimatter Big Bang. And so the sort of antimatter universe that would be more or less like ours at the same age as ours would be far in our future. Whereas what's here is sort of the decayed remnants that's heading back towards our Big Bang or the antimatter's Big Crunch.
So he's suggesting that the matter in these voids may have collapsed into like antimatter black holes. So that's why we wouldn't see it?
Yeah, and stuff like that. So that's going to be the big problem. That's what I think he meant by talking about this different state of the universe. That, yeah, you've got the antimatter black holes. You don't have a lot of really luminous stars out there burning anymore. Everything's burned out and it's just waiting to die. So there's no cool antimatter universe where everybody has goatees or whatever that was.
Would that be a cool universe?
Well.
Would that be a cool universe? That's so 90s.
Well, Spock's goatee was pretty cool.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, Spock's.
Yeah, the 90s goatees weren't, but Spock's was.
He even did a calculation here where he like estimated how much antimatter would have to be within the center, like at a point in the center of the cosmic void for it to have this anti-gravitational property in order for it to have the effect on the local sheet that we're seeing.
Yeah, and that was interesting because it was like a medium-sized cluster. So it was a completely reasonable size. It wasn't saying you need something giant to do this or anything like that. I mean, it was just sort of a normal-sized cluster sitting around doing clustery things.
Yeah, something like 10 to the 15th solar masses of antimatter, anti-gravitating, would do it.
Yeah, 10 to the 15th. 6.6 times 10 to the 15th solar masses in the local void.
Fascinating stuff.
Well, I mean, it would be very, very nice to get a look at that. I mean, it would be nice to get one of these experiments actually finished eventually so that we had a definitive answer about something that sounds fundamental. What happens to antimatter gravity?
Yeah, it seems like a 1930s question, you know.
I mean, this whole thing is really quite interesting. There were a couple of other papers that he did on this same topic, so some of these questions that we have might be answered in those. There's one about dark energy in the lattice or something like that. There's one that's reasonably newer, but most of this guy's work seems to be done in observational astronomy. I don't know what his job is in the collaborations. It doesn't look like he's in big collaborations, but he's in collaborations that he's doing all this research with. So I'm not sure where that is, but it's mostly observing some particular kinds of astronomical objects.
You know, this idea that there's an anti-gravity at the cosmic scale goes back actually as far as the 50s. I remember seeing a paper by Perry Moon, and I think Fritz Zwicky was also talking about this possibility. that gravity appears to reach zero at certain scales beyond galaxy cluster scales. And then beyond that, it could become negative. So that idea has been around for a long time, but it was always dismissed because everybody was so convinced that because of the mass energy equivalence that gravity was always going to be positive.
So those ideas were around, but it looks like Schiff and Good and Morrison pretty much put them to rest in the late 50s.
But then those papers got overturned later because they were found to be flawed.
Well, there are people that are saying that they're flawed. Fairly recently, in the 1990s, people decided to look at this again. But for the obvious reason, right? For the obvious reason that all of a sudden there's this dark energy and we don't know what it is.
Although I've always been kind of perplexed by this idea, by the Hubble constant in the first place. I mean, just the fact that the galaxies are moving away from each other at an accelerating rate, because as you get to larger scales, the Hubble constant's larger, right? So they accelerate away from each other. I think people have this idea that because there was a big bang, that all of the matter got thrown apart like in an explosion, like inertia basically tearing them apart from each other. But the big bang wasn't an explosion like that at all. It was an expansion of space-time. So locally, all of these galaxies are at rest within their own reference frames. And something is making the space expand between them right now. That's always been a feature of our astronomy. And I've never been really satisfied with our explanation of that.
Yeah, that's not really satisfying at all. That's something we can probably look into later on, is to get into some of the particular explanations for why people think that's going on.
Yeah, I think they basically just decided to choose a reference frame where the galaxies are at rest and the space-time's expanding, and then that's just how it is. That's just that we're going to pick this accelerating reference frame. Now that it fits, we don't really need to explain it.
Yeah, I think there's something about that, but that's a little scary. Okay, well, have you got anything else?
No, that's it. I'm really eager to hear what the Dark Energy Survey has to say about all this. I'm hoping they can find some anisotropies in the dark energy field so that we can start to get a mechanistic understanding of what the heck is going on out there. Because this whole idea of a scalar field just isn't satisfying. And if we can finally start solving some of these problems, it would be really a great boon for science.
All right, well, then thank you very much.
Thank you, Jim. You have a wonderful night, and I appreciate you bringing these papers to our discussions.
All right, well, thanks for talking, Randy. Bye now.
All right. Good night.
You have just listened to Physics Frontiers number 34, CPT Symmetry and Gravitation. Show notes can be found at frontiers.physicsfm.com/34. These notes include links to the papers discussed in this program, Alberto Vicaccio's Variational Approach to Gravity Field Theories, which is where I found these papers, and links to related shows. If you're still listening, I assume you like our program. I'd like to ask you to consider becoming a patron of this podcast on Patreon at www.patreon.com/physicsfrontiers. You know, in the past couple of months, we've abetted against our bandwidth limit, and I'm going to have to upgrade soon. And I'd be really grateful for your support while I'm doing that. Obviously, this is great. We've got over 7,500 downloads per month. That's awesome. We are glad you like our show. It's just it's kind of getting a little expensive. So I would be really appreciative if you could help us out. Thank you.